You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am here with an update on three different cases. I don't know about you guys, but this past week, I could not stop checking for news updates on the Orsulya Gall case. It's just so heinous, so tragic and sad. And honestly, I wasn't expecting it to come to a conclusion so soon. Thankful it did. Also up is Lori Vallow, a lot of movement in Lori Vallow case this last week, as well as an update for Suzanne Morphew. Before we get into that, let's just get our quick housekeeping out of the way. You're listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm your host, Robin. And if you want to find the podcast, follow it on social media, head over to our website. It's www.wesawthedevil.com. And our handle on pretty much everything, guys, is We Saw the Devil or We Saw the Devil Podcast. We're pretty easy to find. Beyond that, if you're loving the show and you want to financially support it, become part of the team, you can do so at our Patreon, which is patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And don't forget, for those executive producers, you are able to come on the show and do an episode with me, pick your favorite true crime case, and come on the show and do an episode with me. Guys, we're going to keep the housekeeping light today. We're just going to go ahead and get right into it here. Let's talk about Orsulya Gall. So all of a sudden, this past Saturday morning, like late morning, early afternoon, all of a sudden it hit the media that a woman had been found brutally stabbed to death and then stuffed in a bag, like a gym bag. Obviously, that's not something that you just kind of disregard, right? So I started following it. Now, for those of you who are unaware, we're going to go through what happened chronologically, order of events, and how all of this played out. So a little after 8 a.m. this past Saturday, April 16th, Glenn Van Nostrand was walking his two Rhodesian Ridgebacks through his Forest Hills, Queens neighborhood. All of a sudden, his dog started violently pulling him around the corner of Metropolitan Avenue along a walking path that cuts through the park. They were beelining to a black bag that was on the side of the road. Naturally, wondering why his dogs were going so insane, he decided to open the bag. In an interview, he said that there was some blood pulling. He got up close to the bag, saw some blood pulling out, and then he decided to open it. I mean, you do you, honey boo boo, but that would be a hard no from me. I mean, I'm going to pass, hard pass, on opening a mysterious black bag that's bleeding that my dogs are freaking out over. But again, you do you. In an interview with the New York Post, Van Nostrand described what he saw when he opened the bag. And I am directly quoting this incredible New York Post article. Big props also to the New York Post, especially during this last week, for providing constant details and updates on this case. He said, quote, "He saw black ankle-length jeans, a belt, and a woman's waist. The body was in a fetal position, and the bag had wheels." So he immediately called police. I mean, good thinking. And I love that in this article, his first observation was about his dogs. I mean, I really appreciate it. He said, "They are scent hounds. They see the world through their noses." If any of you guys know me in real life, you know that I am absolutely, positively obsessed with my German short hair pointer named Jupiter. So same. I really appreciated that his entire first take on this is about his dogs. So the police showed up on the scene and he was like, "Hold on, got to drop my dogs off and I'll come into the station to make a full report." He turned around to walk back towards his home, and his dog started pulling him in another direction. He followed them, and then he found a freshish-ish puddle of blood. Now, if you've read any of the myriad articles in the case, or followed it on Twitter, or the New York Post, or Huffington Post, you've probably read that there was a half-mile-long blood trail leading from the home on Juno Street to the resting place of that black duffel bag. I mean, multiple articles have stated this. Mr. Van Nostrand ended up going to the police station and filing his police report, but the police also followed this blood trail from the black duffel bag to the home on Juno Street. And What it led them to was a $2.5 million home in an affluent gated community that belonged to 54-year-old Howard Klein, his 51-year-old wife, Orsolya Gall, and their two sons, 13-year-old Leo and 17-year-old Jamie. So the police made entry into the home. First level was empty. They discovered 13-year-old Leo Klein upstairs in his bedroom. He said that he was home alone, that his dad and brother were out looking at colleges out of town, that he did not know where his mom was, where his mother was. He was detained and taken into custody, but released shortly thereafter into the care of a family member. If you recall, during this time, there was a sudden flurry of breaking news surrounding this case. This is really when it hit. A woman butchered and found in a duffel bag, with her husband and 13-year-old son being persons of interest. Very clear distinction, persons of interest. 13-year-old Leo was actually pretty much immediately cleared, just a couple hours later, very quickly. And media outlets posted updates saying that the son and husband were no longer suspects. Okay, so the son is out. It was confirmed that the deceased victim was 51-year-old Orsolya Gall, again, married to Howard Klein. So who is Howard Klein? As this horror show was playing out in New York, Howard and his son Jamie were out of town. They went to Oregon to look at colleges and then through Michigan. Jamie's 17 years old and getting ready, trying to pick that college. Howard himself graduated from the University of Michigan in 1990 and apparently met Orsolya Gall while he was later working in Budapest. Orsolya was attending the Budapest Business School College of International Management and Business. Howard apparently brought her back to the United States and married her. Now, Howard's LinkedIn says that he is the creator of RK Equity and currently works there as a partner. His company is described as a, quote, New York-based boutique capital markets consultancy firm. It's more or less a company that trades lithium, what they use to make batteries. Obviously, once Howard and Jamie learned about the brutal murder of Orsolya, they hopped on a plane to fly back to New York. Not only that, but that morning early, Howard had received two text messages on his phone that said, "Your whole family is next," as well as, "Your wife sent me to jail some years ago. I'm back." And Howard made a very public statement saying that he was afraid for his family's lives, that they were in danger. And the mystery only got deeper this past Sunday and Monday, the next day, when additional information came out. Orsolya Gall actually went missing 2 years ago as well. Her husband Howard had called 911 just a tiny bit after 7 a.m. on May 29th, 2020, to say that his wife had not returned from a walk the night before. Coincidentally, she arrived home 30 minutes later to the family residence. That fact added a little bit more intrigue into the story. So back to the present day. When police retraced her steps, they found that she had attended a concert at the Lincoln Center with a family friend before returning to a local bar in her neighborhood. She drank there alone in that bar for 40 minutes before she left, arriving home around 12:35 a.m. Now, there have been multiple reports from witnesses in the bar that night saying that it appeared as though she had been waiting for someone to show up. She drank there by herself and then she left. In later interviews with the bar manager, servers, and bartenders there, it was not uncommon for Orsolya Gall to actually drink there alone. So that was not weird or outside the realm of her normal behavior. So she returned home around 12:35 a.m. And sadly, the murder would happen shortly after this in the basement. And then the most shocking piece of evidence surfaced. Surveillance video from a doorbell camera off of 75th Avenue, just a couple blocks away from Orsolya Gall's home. This footage captured a dark figure pulling a bag down the street, like a bag on wheels, the same bag in which Orsolya Gall was found. And people went apeshit over this, speculating who it could have been. Almost every Facebook group or Reddit thread, they were trying to pin it on the son, saying, "Look, that figure has a very light, slender build. So does her son. It has to be her son." I mean, the speculation was completely out there. News then came out that police were looking for a handyman who worked on the family's home who also knew where the spare key was, but they didn't release any names or pictures. They also indicated that he could have been a, quote, previous lover of Orsolya's. Police also released information that indicated, quote, Gall had contact with at least three men that night. One of them was the handyman. On Tuesday morning, police put up $3,500 reward posters around Orsolya Gall's neighborhood, asking the public for more information on this murder. The family's electrician actually spoke out in an interview on Wednesday, saying that the entire home had a very advanced security system, indicating that the crime could very well have actually been caught on camera. And then Thursday morning, an arrest was made. 44-year-old David Bonola, who somehow looks like a Wish version of Slash if you bought him online. He apparently confessed to the murder. Police were in his neighborhood canvassing and watching it, supposedly him. He saw them, he walked up to them, made some small chat, and then eventually said, "I hear you're looking for me." And then he actually confessed. He confessed once to police and then again actually on record on video. Police would later release a Gall family CCTV footage still from their home's personal security system, showing David Bonola approaching the home in dark clothing with his face partially covered. And they had actually been surveilling Bonola for a couple of days. He was very much immediately on their radar. Apparently, he and Orsolya Gall had been having an affair for 2.5 years. There was ample text evidence of this. They were aware that he and her had communicated and met up the day before. Between that and the surveillance camera footage, they, you know, more or less knew it was him, but they needed to get the warrant. So what they did is they were waiting for the trash, for the garbage to be picked up so that they could look through it. Trash day came. The garbage was picked up at Bonola's residence. They opened it and they found a pair of bloody boots in the trash. They tested it for DNA, and that is 100% one of the biggest pieces of evidence they have on Bonola, other than him obviously being at the home at 12:30 a.m. outside dressed in black. I mean, you can't get more, you know, obvious than that. So apparently what they believe happened is they believe that he and Gall have been communicating throughout the day. He showed up unannounced and uninvited a little after 12:30 a.m., she let him into the home. They started arguing. They went downstairs into the basement. She asked him to leave multiple times. He grabbed a knife out of her kitchen, slashed her throat, and proceeded to stab her 59 times, primarily on her left side. He got her carotid artery. He slit her throat. It was very, 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 very brutal. And when we hear of cases like this, 59 stab wounds, that's personal. You know, you don't think of someone randomly coming in off the street, committing a crime like this. You think of, okay, there's anger and passion behind that. And I think that initially, that's why so many people tried to implicate and say that her son did it. Orsolya was known as a loving mom, always talking about their interests and hobbies and what they were doing and how proud she was of them, which makes it even more sad that her 13-year-old son, Leo, was detained. Can you imagine being a child asleep in bed and all of a sudden you hear a commotion downstairs, so it wakes you up. And then all of a sudden the police are like, you know, where's your mom? Who's here? And then you're detained. You're detained and simultaneously learn that your mother has been brutally murdered. You don't have time to grieve because you're being taken into a police station barefoot in pajamas at 13 years old. Thankfully, they were able to clear him pretty quickly, but I just cannot imagine the level of psychological trauma that this poor child endured. David Bonola would later say that the entire reason of why he moved Orsolya's body from the home is because he didn't want her children finding her. The half-mile-long blood trail that he left by stuffing her body into her son's hockey bag accomplished that goal for some reason, I guess. Absolutely sick, sick individual. The medical examiner found that she had the 59 stab and slash wounds, mostly in her neck and upper body. Her carotid artery and trachea were both cut. She also had wounds on her hands, indicating that she had put up a fight. Very little is actually known about David Bonola. We know that he came to the U.S. from Mexico roughly 21 or so years ago. He apparently had dreams of becoming a filmmaker, and he claimed, at least on his Facebook profile, that he had been a student at the New York School of Interior Design. At least that's what he claimed on Facebook. He was, in fact, a Facebook friend of Orsolya Gall, and he would react with like hearts and starry eyes and call her beautiful on many of her posts. He was downright flirtatious on his posts with Orsolya Gall, which, okay, did not hide that whatsoever. Then it came out further that he was an absolute creep. He would go into Starbucks and he would start complimenting different female baristas about how they looked. He would even bring jewelry into the Starbucks and offer it to them if they would marry him. He did, in fact, propose to multiple baristas. He would write poems about different women there that he found attractive. And he would do the same thing to patrons who were waiting in line. The baristas at Starbucks actually had to call the police on him a number of times because of just how creepy he was. Like, did not know how to read a room. Very, very disturbing. Interestingly enough, David Bonola is also married with a child himself. He himself was not single when he was carrying on an affair with Orsolia. He had a wife and a child, just like Orsolia had a husband and two children as well. Apparently, he killed Orsolia. He immediately sent the text messages to her husband, threatening the rest of the family. And then about 4:30 in the morning, he was in the home for 3 hours before he decided to take her body, put it into the bag, and then carry it to the park. That happened Saturday. He was arrested on Thursday. Absolutely horrible case. My heart breaks for Howard Klein and the two children. That is just absolutely horrible. Alrighty, guys. So moving on, let's talk about Suzanne Morphew. It's been a very, very, very long time. I wish that I had better news here for you. This past Tuesday, the state prosecutors in the case against Barry Morphew, again, the state prosecutors, the ones who are trying to convict him of this crime, they actually filed a motion to dismiss the charges against him without prejudice. I know that my knee-jerk reaction was obviously, what the fuck? They really have nothing. They can't try this. And then I immediately started using my mental Rolodex of all the cases where people have been committed without a body being found. But then the court documents came out, and I am actually 100% behind this decision. And honestly, it gives me a little bit of hope based on the language in these documents. With prejudice means that the state attorney's office can refile charges in the future. They're basically being rushed by the trial timeline. Imagine, for example, if in another case, if someone goes missing at random and they think they know where the body is, but something, weather isn't permitting them to, say, unearth or find this body, which would be monumental evidence or monumental in the case. But they're being confined by the timeline in order to give someone, you know, in the United States, a trial. It has to be in a timely manner. They can actually file a motion to dismiss without prejudice so that if or when they find evidence down the road, they can refile the charges and proceed again. And that's what's happening here. It sounds like investigators feel like they have found or identified where Suzanne Morphew is buried. And here's a snippet from this motion to dismiss. Quote, as an offer of proof, the people and law enforcement believe we are close to discovering the victim's body. The people were hopeful that the search for and the discovery of the victim's body would be concluded well before trial, but weather has complicated the efforts. Specifically, the area law enforcement has been focused on is in a remote and mountainous region nearby the Morphew residence. This area received a significant amount of snow over the winter months before a search could be completed. To date, this area has 5 feet of snow concealing the location where the people believe Miss Morphew is located. As a result, the people cannot safely excavate this area and resolve this unanswered question. That is huge. If that is all true, I mean, it blindsided us, right? Like, we didn't really know that they thought, that they were pretty certain that they had possibly found Suzanne Morphew's body. And that's going to be huge if that is the case. The judge in this trial, in my opinion, has shown an immense amount of favoritism to Barry Morphew. I don't understand it in any capacity. Defense attorneys have been getting win this entire time. Granted, the prosecutors have, you know, fumbled quite a bit in this case. There are some rulings that I just simply do not understand. I mean, if you recall just a couple weeks ago, the judge's orders pretty much gutted the prosecution's entire case because it took away almost all of their experts, 12 of them. And the prosecution didn't appeal that ruling or take it ultimately to the Supreme Court. Why? The judge stripped the prosecution's witnesses, said no, they cannot testify. The prosecution did, in fact, have the ability to appeal that ruling and, you know, and fight that ruling, but they chose not to. I mean, why? I have absolutely no idea. Maybe they know a little bit more about the potential body or the remains that they're searching for. Let's not kid ourselves. Had Barry Morphew gone to trial, say like on the same time frame and whatnot, if he went to trial right now, it would 100% likely result in a not guilty verdict. Filing this motion was actually in the best interest of the case. It keeps it alive, at least. It gives law enforcement the ability to complete the investigation and hopefully unearth her body. I mean, she deserves justice. Her family deserves justice. And considering everything we know about the evidence and Barry Morphew and his movements and his sketchy behavior, if you don't think that Barry Morphew killed Suzanne Morphew, I have beachfront property in Nebraska to sell you. I can't fathom there being another option to that. Everything we know, just read the arrest affidavit. That's all you have to do. So now, guys, we wait, hope, and if any of you guys pray, I don't pray, that they find Suzanne's body and somehow DNA or GPS evidence points to Barry having been at that location. It was very pleasing to hear that the location is, in fact, nearby the Morphew residence, and they're only being hindered by snow. We're in spring. It's April. Pretty soon, that will not be the case. And I am hoping for the day when I hear that Suzanne Morphew's remains have been found, and then the state can refile the charges with the updated evidence, hopefully, and we can see Barry Morphew's ass right back in jail, right back going to court. That is what I'm hoping for. So tying up the rear, guys, we're going to be talking about Lori Vallow. So on April 11th, Judge Boyce issued a written order saying that Lori Daybell is competent for trial and fit to proceed. She was then ordered to be released from a Department of Health and Welfare facility, and an arraignment date was set. And she showed up. She sure did. This last week, we had her arraignment. And I mean, Lori came out, got her hairs did, which I think that was one of the most shocking things, is seeing that she looked really, you know, actually kind of nice for court. She was wearing a blue sweater, glasses, had her hair done, and she didn't say a word. She stayed completely silent. Jim Archibald is now her head attorney, and he spoke for her, entering pleas of not guilty. Jim Archibald also declined to waive her right to a speedy trial. So that means that her trial must take place within 6 months or by October 19th, 2022. And recently released court documents show that the jury trial for Lori Vallow will now begin on October 11th and will take place at the Ada County Courthouse in Boise. Interestingly enough, Chad Daybell is also headed to a jury trial. Don't forget, their cases have not been severed. Judge Boyce declined to sever those cases. Back in March, Judge Boyce denied the request from John Pryor to sever Chad's case from Lori's. So Chad wants to get away from Lori. And I'm just wondering, is Lori aware that Chad's like, nope, I do not want to be tried with this crazy bitch? And then his children got on national news and basically said that their father was completely sweet and normal until he met her. I wonder if Lori has been made aware of that via, you know, Archibald or even Mark Means before he got the shit can of, hey, no, you really need to figure out your strategy here. Like, Chad is trying to separate himself with you, potentially to throw you under the bus. I'm just curious how much cross communication goes on between John Pryor and Means and now Archibald. What's probably going to happen is Chad Daybell's trial is going to be moved up. It's what I'm imagining. I do not believe that they are going to be severed. I don't know. There's a lot coming, guys. I don't know. This week was very, very, very fruitful. This week's news cycle was... But that's it for the three updates on these cases, guys. The brutal slaying of Orsolya Gall, absolutely tragic. It sounds like, in terms of Suzanne Morphew, law enforcement is on the cusp of making a large discovery, hopefully. And then in the case of Lori Vallow, will she and Chad still be tried together? Will Judge Stephen Boyce cave in and allow the severance of these two trials? Will Chad's be moved up to match Lori's? Will they turn on one another? Lots of questions ahead. And then tonight, some super interesting breaking news. Justin Lum, as well as East Idaho News, published the probate filing by Tammy Daybell's daughter, Emma Murray. And she was appointed the personal representative for Tammy's estate last year. So on this particular death certificate, because death certificates are listed and included in the probate filing, you can see that Tammy Daybell's death was listed as natural. And the coroner's name was Brenda Dye, and she has it listed as a cardiac event and pulmonary edema. That was the very first death certificate. And just so we are clear, pulmonary edema is what Tammy Daybell died from. Alex Cox, if you recall, his death certificate actually says pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in the lung. What this also shows is that Tammy Daybell's father and father-in-law renounced and gave up their rights to be the personal representative for Tammy and nominated Emma as well. This is what actually set it up so that Chad Daybell could more or less sign his home over to John Pryor in order, I mean, let's keep it real, for payment. So that was an interesting little discovery this evening that came out. And then finally, the last thing that I have here for you guys, and this is such good news, it made me want to cry when I heard it earlier. Texas's highest criminal court delayed the execution of Melissa Lucio. She was set to die in 2 days. 2 days. And the decision from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals came down. The Board of Pardons and Paroles was also, they had been in discussion. They're about to potentially recommend to Governor Greg Abbott whether or not to stay her execution. The Court of Criminal Appeals came and delayed it. Thank the universe. So now a lower court can review the claims that she's innocent. Like all the new evidence that everyone's talking about that would potentially exonerate her or prove that it was an accident or at least give more, you know, put some more doubt in there, right? If you're unsure of who I'm talking about, please check out the previous episode where I detail her story and talk about that. This was about to be one of the biggest travesties in the American legal system from the last several years. And as of right now, at least, it looks like she's going to get a second chance to prove using that new evidence. But before I go, I want some recommendations. What have you guys been watching lately? I recently watched this week Undercurrents, The Disappearance of Kim Wall. It's available on HBO Max. I highly, highly suggest it. It's a two-part documentary directed by Erin Lee Carr. If you're familiar, she did I Love You, Now Die, the case about Michelle Carter, as well as Britney versus Spears. I Love You, Now Die is one of my absolute all-time favorite documentaries. It's a two-part documentary series as well. But The Disappearance of Kim Wall is one of the most powerful documentaries I've seen in quite a while. It's masterful, really. If you guys recall, back in 2017, it was international news. And what happened is journalist Kim Wall reached out to entrepreneur slash inventor creator Peter Madsen. She wanted to write a story on him and the submarine that he had just created, and he offered her to come write in it, come check it out. They'll sail around the bay. She took him up on that offer, and he murdered her in that submarine. And it became a huge international story. And I followed it when it hit the news. I was thinking, oh, wow, this is not something that you see every day. A woman goes missing on a... And then it fell off my radar. But this documentary is so emotionally impactful. It's politically important. And Erin Lee Carr does just such a masterful job of bringing it together, showing a tremendous amount of respect for Kim Wall as the victim in this story. We really, truly get a feeling of who she was, how much she was loved by her peers as well as her family. Like this is a person, a journalist, who absolutely wanted to make a difference in the world. She wanted to peel back the blocks and layers and give access to the everyday people to see, you know, things that were going on all over the world, little news stories, and give exposure to them. And then she was able to get interviews with Denmark law enforcement and people who, members of the military and the police who found the body, did the investigation. And it's such a great documentary. Highly, highly, highly recommend. And then moving on to the only other thing that I've watched related to true crime this week is the Gacy tapes, actually the new show on Netflix. I'm not going to lie, guys. John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, I almost could not care less if I tried. I know a lot of people are really interested in them and read up on them a lot, but they're just not interesting to me really that much at all. But I did decide that I would watch the Gacy tapes, and I found it very well produced. The interviews were really wonderful, and I was thoroughly engaged the entire time, thoroughly interested. So the Gacy tapes is out on Netflix, I believe new this week, but I'm not sure how much longer The Murder of Kim Wall is going to be on HBO Max. So if you haven't seen it, immediately seek that one out. But that's it for today, guys. Again, I'm Robin. This is We Saw the Devil. Next episode will be coming on Tuesday, and it is going to be an episode titled What the Fuck is Going On in Ukraine? This has actually been a conversation that I've been having with a lot of people. Like, you may have seen the news and what's going on in Ukraine, the horrible war crimes. It's absolute true crime. I mean, it's war crimes. You can't get any much more truth than that. Change your profile picture over to Ukraine, support Ukraine, but do you know what's actually going on there? Why we are on the precipice of a potential nuclear war, World War III, which, by the way, Russia last week said that we are already in World War III. Like, this is World War III. So I know a lot of people are confused. So I'm going to give you a primer. And it's going to be super interesting because you're going to understand the geopolitical impact of, you know, our policy and what's going on, and just basically get a really easy to digest and understand primer on what's going on in Ukraine so we can all follow along together. You know, I'm a political junkie myself. My undergraduate degree is in French language and literature and political science because I wanted to be an international relations attorney or just, you know, live in France at the time. And I've just always been obsessed with politics, geopolitical situations, and things like that. And this topic is absolutely fascinating to me. We got you covered. So again, guys, it's been real. This is Robin. You've been listening to We Sell the Devil. Website is wesellthedevil.com. Patreon is patreon.com/wesellthedevil. Come join us, support the show, become part of the team. And I will talk to you guys next week. Until next crime.